So what were you doing the day of the moon landing?
Oh, that's a day I'll never, ever forget. Certain dates you remember because they have an impact on your life. This was one of them.
On July 20th, 1969, Ed Karfeld is a captain in the Marine Corps, and he's adjusting to life in a war zone for the first time. He's been in Vietnam for about 2 weeks at this point, away from his family, adjusting to cold coffee and cold showers and sleeping on a cot. He's getting used to the constant threat of danger. On his first day there, he heard two bullets snap through the air just above his head. And now he's at a new base, Hill 34. The Marines tell him to expect more incoming fire later that night.
Maybe they were trying to scare me. They didn't have to try very hard.
Although he went through rifle training like any other Marine, Karfeld is a lawyer. He's a defense attorney for Marines facing court. And he's in this part of Vietnam because that's where the trials are being held. The courtroom isn't a courtroom. Not really. It's a hooch, which is military for hut with a metal roof. On this particular day, Karfeld is defending some kid who got caught with contraband.
He was about 18 years old. There was an inspection, and in the lint of the pocket of his trousers, they found a marijuana seed. Around 11 o'clock, 11:30, we're in the middle of this court-martial, and I'm examining a witness, and all of a sudden, an F-4 fighter jet flies right overhead, loud as could be, shakes the building. You can't hear yourself think.
He and the rest of the court stop the trial to watch this fighter jet. And once it's quiet enough that he can hear his own thoughts again, Karfeld has a moment of reflection.
And I sit there and I'm thinking, here I am. There's a war going on. There's Marines out there fighting for their lives.
Americans are functioning directly in the fight for freedom in this far, foreign corner of the earth.
I'm defending this 18-year-old kid. We're having a marijuana seed in his pocket. There's protests going on in the country.
Some 400 demonstrators are arrested. Two soldiers are injured and tear gas.
And we're landing a man on the moon.
The Eagle has landed. Roger, tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys.
July 20th, 1969. I said, this is surreal.
At this point, Karfeld is eager for a taste of normalcy. An officer tells him there's going to be a show that night. Some entertainers are coming all the way out to Hill 34 for a performance. Like a Bob Hope type thing. So Karfeld gets himself ready. It's getting dark when he heads to the club. He's still thinking about the incoming fire the Marines warned him about. And this club is really just a thatched roof hut with some overhead fans stirring the humid air. Marines are packed into every inch of this small room.
So I'm about maybe 5 feet from the stage, and it was a very cramped quarter, so the stage itself was not very big. The performers are there, and it was wonderful. I mean, it was just a few moments of being back in the real world, where there were pretty girls, rock musicians, people sitting around having a drink, having a good time. And it was a memory of what things were, you know, 2-3 weeks prior.
Part of that night's performance had featured a comedian and dancers, but the climax of the show is a young blonde woman who can't be older than 20, a lead singer. She launches into a rendition of Stevie Wonder's Uptight.
They're playing, and all of a sudden, she just falls down. And for a moment, you know, the band's continuing to play. We think this is just part of the act. They're all, you know, joking around. But then the band stops, and I look down, and there's blood in her blouse.
She's been shot. And then she dies right there on stage. The Marines scatter, yelling that there's a sniper in the camp. Karfeld runs to his hooch to grab his weapon. He didn't learn until later that the singer was an Australian named Kathy Wayne, and that the bullet was likely fired by one of the Marines, someone who Kathy had come to entertain. Hi, I'm Bijan Stephen, and I'm the host of Eclipsed. I'm a journalist who's covered everything from books to TV to music. I love video games, and I am a child of the internet. And that last bit, I think that's also why I love history. Through the internet, I've gotten to learn about all kinds of marginal hidden stories. It's convinced me that the past is our best guide to the present. So that's why I'm here. I'm interested in tales from the end of the archive. Stories, in other words, that were eclipsed. Overshadowed by Father Time. Like, what important events did we miss just because we were paying attention to something else that day? What stories were thrown below the fold because they happened in the wrong place or to the wrong person? What did we not notice? This is the history we're interested in here on Eclipsed. In the end, what unites all these stories is that we find them meaningful, and that we think you will too. Me and the rest of Team Eclipsed will bring you new reported episodes every week. You'll learn about everything from stock market crashes to the destructive power of fruit flies. Together, we'll explore the dustier corners of the past, and I'll be your guide, the Virgil to your Dante. In this three-part series, we're telling a story that was eclipsed by the moon landing.
It's one small step for man.
Kathy Wayne, a young Australian pop star, is shot dead on an American military base. It's the sort of event you could picture becoming an international incident. But the entire world is fixated on the moon landing.
You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again.
Including Kathy Wayne's fellow Australians, like this excited reporter for the Sydney Sun.
It's still almost impossible to believe that right out there in front of me, there are three men strapped into their seats at the top of that huge rocket.
Kathy's story didn't get the attention it deserved because we were looking elsewhere. And as we'll see, that lack of attention may well have robbed her family of a chance at justice. Kathy was one of hundreds of Australian musicians who flooded to Vietnam to entertain the troops. And this is their story, too. The legacy of Australian musicians in Vietnam isn't just about Kathy's murder, though obviously we want to honor her memory. There's a larger story here, one about what happens when the highs of teen pop stardom meet the horrors of war. This is episode one, The Moon and the Pop Stars. In the 1960s in Australia, there was a show called Brian Henderson's Bandstand. It was the little brother to American Bandstand. The show featured some of the hottest acts in Australian pop music, and regulars were known as the Bandstand family. Other groups came through too, including the three brothers who made up the Bee Gees, who appeared when they were just little kids singing folk music.
The three brothers, the Bee Gees.
You know, before they grew beards and put on tight pants and kept people up all night dancing. A lot of the Bandstand family was as big as they could get in Australia. There was always the question of whether they'd break through to the international pop scene, you know, like the Bee Gees. And that's what all the other performers were striving towards. Bandstand featured a lot of very young artists. And two of the youngest were these blonde teenage pop singers, same age, both from the working class suburbs of Sydney. And they both would have their lives forever altered while performing in Vietnam. One was known as Little Patty. The other was Kathy Wayne. Kathy first appeared on Bandstand in 1966.
If you're 16, therefore, all this year you're going to be known as the Bandstand Baby.
And so shy, she could barely speak in the onstage interview.
Are you? Yeah. He's our Bandstand Baby.
This Bandstand appearance at age 16 is a big opportunity for Kathy, who still has a long way to go in showbiz. She's got an agent at one of Australia's best talent agencies, but she works as an assistant at that same agency to earn money while she waits for her career to take off. The other blonde 16-year-old on Bandstand is in an entirely different situation.
And here's someone, well, we all know who she is, Little Patty.
It's hard to describe just how big Little Patty is in 1960s Australia. We got to talk to her, and she's the most humble former teen pop star you'll ever meet.
I'm amazed the amount of times I can hear my own heartbeat.
She was even a little bit anxious about her interview with us.
And I'm not super anxious at all, but I've been anxious enough to hear my heart.
We wanted to talk to Patty because her story is interesting in its own right, but also because we can't talk to Kathy and because we know they had remarkably similar lives, careers, and even dreams. Little Patty came on the scene at the age of 14, but she isn't your typical child star prodded into the spotlight by her parents. In fact, she and her family never even intended for her to be a performer. it just sort of happened, which makes her success that much more incredible.
My record was called He's My Blonde-Headed Stompy Wompy Real Gone Surfer Boy. Pretty long. With my blonde-headed stompy wompy real gone surfer boy, yeah. I had number one record, then it went to number two because the Beatles were number one, etc. So that was most enjoyable, and I was envied by all of my friends. Let's go surfing. Okay, Sandy.
While Patti's hit is going back and forth on the charts with I Want to Hold Your Hand, the Beatles visit Australia.
I went to the stadium, which is a venue in Sydney, to see them, and of course they're wonderful. And I did what every other kid did, you know, stood on the chair and screamed, and everyone was looking at me because I was a bit famous and being stupid.
Once the show's over, Patti thinks she's out of the spotlight for the evening. But then the Beatles' manager invites her to a special event, Paul McCartney's 22nd birthday party. Patti's still young enough that she has to get permission from the child welfare department every time she makes an appearance on TV. So to go to Paul McCartney's birthday party, she has to call home and get permission from her mom.
I had to find a phone box, and I said, Mom, I think I'm going to be late. She said, who's looking after you? And I told her who was, you know. She said, yeah, you just have a lovely time.
When Patti arrives, she's a wallflower. It's a pretty intimidating scene. I mean, imagine your middle school self going up to the biggest star in the world at his birthday party.
The place was full of beautiful models, and they were, drop-dead gorgeous. And there's silly me, 15, and not gorgeous. And I was just sitting there, you know, my shy self on show.
Patti is Australia's pop star hero, the one battling the biggest band in the world at the top of the charts. But it's a lot to ask of a young person. Patti doesn't know what to do with herself at the party, and she probably has homework to do. She's just sitting there, but then she sees all four of the Beatles walking through the party in her direction.
I got such a surprise that the Beatles surrounded me and talked to me about my record, and I can still remember the feeling. And they spent a lot of time with me, and I thought, wow, this is pretty special.
After meeting the Beatles, Patti tours all over Australia with all the biggest Australian acts. And when international performers come through town, she works with them as well.
I traveled with wonderful people. I was very protected, but I had my eyes wide open. I didn't miss a trick. So life was very much a learning experience all the way for me, and it still is. I'm a sticky beak.
Can you explain what that means for American listeners?
It means I'm inquisitive, curious, have to see it all. At the same time, I really, you know, I wasn't a natural performer because before I became a performer, I was quite nerdy. So I had to learn to show off, really, and got pretty good at showing off.
She's getting better. Her career is flourishing. But once you've had a hit record, hung out with the Beatles at Paul McCartney's birthday party, toured every part of your home country, and you're only 16 years old, what are you going to do next? On the other hand, while Patti's career continued to grow, her family and her country were going through a dark time. In 1962, Australia decided to join the United States to fight in Vietnam. Now, it's 1966. The war has dragged on for 4 years. And Australia is sending more and more young men to the battlefield.
In our street, with the exception of one house in four blocks, every single family had a son who might have been conscripted.
One of those young men was Patti's older brother, Joe. So Patti's family was waiting for the call. And one day, the family phone did ring. And it was the Australian Department of Defense. But they weren't calling for Patti's brother. They wanted little Patti.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
In April of 1966, Patty had just turned 17.
I was home with Mum one day, and I think I probably would have had a gig to go to that night. And, you know, the one black phone in the lounge room rang.
Patty didn't know who the caller was, but she knew from her mom's tone that this call was important. It was clear the adults were talking about Patty's future. The caller's end of the conversation was always brief, but her mom talked a great deal.
I heard my mum say, "Oh, I don't know about that. I'll have to ask her father. That's not a question I could answer." And when she got off the phone, she said that it was a man from the Department of Defense and that he was asking for her and my dad's permission to send me to Vietnam to entertain our forces.
Patty knew immediately that she wanted to go. She wanted the adventure. A chance to go abroad was a huge deal, and she was attracted to the idea of serving her country, even if she didn't have much of an opinion about the war itself. Patty's mom took her side, but Patty's father was another matter entirely. And this split in the family mirrored the split in Australia.
It was very much a country divided. My father was bitterly opposed to the Vietnam War, so Dad was on that side. I have to say this, my mother was a very sweet, lovely person, and my dad, was not sweet. And Mum, in an effort to talk him into the permission for me to go, would say things like, "Oh, Joseph, it's all right. I think we can trust this man who phoned. She's going to get fed 3 meals a day. Soldiers will be looking after her with 50 caliber machine guns. And what's more, the man who phoned, we can trust him because, after all, he's from the government," which is very funny. No one trusts any government here.
At first, Patty's dad held firm. But he finally started wearing down once Patty's co-performer was on board for the trip. Cole Joy was the biggest of names in Australian music, and Patty had already toured extensively with Cole and his band, the Joy Boys. So Patty's dad changed his mind. He let her go with one condition.
As long as I went to the library and read some books about Vietnam, there weren't many. There were books about this place called Indochina. I did know that it wasn't just a tiny little conflict, that it was an actual war. You know, bodies were coming back to Australia too. Once we were landed in Saigon, it was very, very serious, and you just knew it, you know. It was, I'm on another planet now.
Patty played her hits for groups of hundreds and sometimes thousands of adoring Australian troops as soon as she arrived.
They were Australian boys who all looked like my brother, actually. And of course, I thought of them as that too. Maybe I reminded them of their girlfriends, their sisters, mothers, whatever. They would confide in me and they'd cry sometimes. And, you know, I had to grow up too to deal with comforting them.
And then, just 6 days into her time in Vietnam, Patty saw a side of the war she never would have expected. On the next episode of Eclipsed, Patty finds herself in the midst of a very dangerous situation. And soon, other members of the Banson family follow Patty to Vietnam, including her friend and fellow blonde-headed pop singer, Kathy Wayne. Eclipsed is a production of Campside Media. It's hosted by me, Bijan Steven, and written by Michael Canyon Meyer. were produced by Lane Gerbig and Joe Hawthorne. Archival research by Caitlin Rathie, with additional research by Morgan Lee Davies. We're fact-checked by Jordan Reed. Our engineer is Garrett Tiedemann. Our theme song is by Doug Slatman. Our executive producers are me, Bijan Steven, and the rookie contender for Dad of the Year, Michael Kandenmeyer. The executive producers at Campside Media are Matt Scheer, Adam Hoff, Josh Dean, and Vanessa Gregoriadis. And special thanks to avgeeks.com for letting us use some archival audio in our trailer. If you want to say hello or what's up, drop us a line at eclipsed@campsidemedia.com. And if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me at Bijan Steven on Twitter and Twitch, but not Instagram. That's different. I mean, not really. It's just a different username. Anyway, thanks for listening. See you next time.